You're listening to the Rural Advancement Podcast. Rural Advancement provides resources to empower, equip, and encourage rural pastors and churches. Join our community by visiting us at ruraladvancement.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Rural Advancement. This is the podcast that is by rural leaders and for rural leaders. It is our goal every single week, week in and week out, to bring you content that is not just spoken to the rural church, but is spoken by people who get it, people who have lived, worked, and ministered in small, out-of-the-way places, and people who understand the immense value of the work that God is doing there. I am your host, Joe Epley, and today I'm excited to dive into the first part of what I perceive is going to be a two-part conversation with Martin Geese. He serves as the president of Oaks Hill Christian College in Bemidji, Minnesota. I got to get all these names right, you know. And I've had just such a delightful conversation with him in preparation for this episode, talking about what rural looks like in the 21st century, how we see the urban and rural cultures collide, and just kind of getting a set of language and mindsets that help us succeed in rural and face the problems that we face head on. And so I'm just delighted to dive into this conversation with him. I think it's going to be an enriching time for me personally, but also for all of you as our listeners. But first, I want to say, Martin, how you doing, man?
I'm doing well, Joel. I count it a privilege to talk with you today and to the listeners who will tune in at some point. I'm in north central Minnesota and the sun is shining. And, you know, you're in Montana, Joe. And so you understand where winter has begun here in northern Minnesota. It's just above zero. We've got some snow on the ground. It's going to be a white Christmas. And going to go to a basketball game tonight at our college. So looking forward to that as well.
Awesome. Well, yeah, I definitely sympathize with you that any sunny day you get, even if it's cold, is still a win, you know, for a wintry state. So,
yes, it is.
Well, let's start with this. I always love to dive into the story of people, kind of figure out where they're coming from and what their journey has been. And I feel like today is a great opportunity to do that. You've been at ministry in some way, shape, or fashion for a while. And I would just love to hear you walk through that journey. You know, maybe it starts with you at a young age or you attending college or whatever you feel like, you know, but walk us sure. through the journey of how you got from then to now and what that looks like.
Sure. So I grew up on a farm in western Minnesota and attended an evangelical church. Although it was a troubled church, I came to Christ in gospel meetings at the age of 8. Married my high school sweetheart, and because of the difficulty in that little rural church, had a burden for healthy ministry. In preparing to marry my wife, we studied the scriptures together, and I really awakened a desire to study more. And so I ended up as a student, as a newly married student at Oak Hills Christian College, my alma mater, and now where I'm serving. So God rerouted my life. I was thinking that I was going to be a part of the family business, agribusiness. It was a successful farming operation. But instead ended up spending 40 years as a rural church pastor by God's call and design. Two churches that I served, both in Minnesota, one for 17 years and then one for 23 years, before accepting a call to return to one of my alma maters, Oak Hills, in this role of leadership. I was deeply impacted as a teenager by godly pastor Joe in our home church. We were very, as a difficult church, we were unkind to our leaders, our pastors. Sure. And this pastor exhibited the joy of the Lord and a love for life, in addition to a love for Jesus, stayed longer than his predecessors. And for reasons that still are not clear other than God's grace, he took an interest in me and sometimes against my will, invited me into leadership. I would lead singing and occasionally lead in prayer as a young guy. One Sunday surprised me and had me co-lead communion. Mm. And I tried to hide out in the back of the little building,
sure,
like Saul among the baggage.
Sure.
And he would locate me and thrust me in. And of course, now I can look back and see he was, by God's design, he was introducing me to ministry. But as I entered ministry, I mentioned a moment ago, I did so with a desire to see a long-term healthy church in a rural setting. And that is not totally unusual, but I had not seen that. And
Sure.
so grateful to the Lord for allowing us to have my family and I to have longer term ministries. I'm married 50 years,
Wow.
and we were married at age six. Just kidding. And then I'm the father of three girls and a boy, and now we're grandparents of 15 grandchildren, and so we're collecting those. It's a great hobby, Joe. We're
That's what I've
delighted.
heard. Yeah,
My our son is also a pastor, and so I stay in touch with pastoral ministry in a variety of capacities, and do 40 years as a rural pastor. 30 of those years, I've been involved in rural church leadership training. I spent 10 years with the Billy Graham Schools of Evangelism while a pastor and their adjunct faculty, and studied at some other institutions. In my master's work, founded a ministry to rural churches called the Country Shepherds Workshop, and that was sponsored for 14 years here on the Oak Hills campus. And then that material I have used across North America for the subsequent years. So about, as I mentioned, about 30 years of doing leadership training for rural pastors and leaders.
Wow. Well, tell us a little bit about Oak Hills Christian College. How long have you served as president there, and what's the college like?
Yeah, well, Joe, we're in our 8th year of service to Oak Hills in this capacity. Oak Hills was founded as a mission, and remains a mission to this day. In 1926, missionaries with the American Sunday School Union felt a burden of the Lord to come to what was then called the Cutover region of Minnesota. We have a logging history, as
Oh,
do
sure.
parts of Montana.
Yeah.
And the large logging companies utilized a great many European immigrants who had the skills. The idea, Joe, a little backstory here, the idea was that the timber was significant enough that you could never cut it all.
Oh, yeah.
So European immigrants were invited to come and spend several generations in their work. In fact, it took about 50 years to cut from the coast of Maine to the Red River Valley here in western Minnesota. And then the big companies move west. Some of this story your Montana listeners are already aware of. A German immigrant by the name of Weyerhaeuser, in his move, bought 900,000 acres for cash in the Great
Sure.
Northwest when he left Minnesota. But what ensued here in northern Minnesota was poverty. We have a short growing season, very little topsoil in northern Minnesota. And so the missionaries were coming to share the gospel with impoverished people, many of whom, for whom English was a second language.
Sure.
They planted 22 churches, and in about 20 years, I should add, several thousand children collectively through the years enrolled in Know Your Bible clubs. Those
Sure.
children came of age and sought additional Bible training. And so in 1946, the college was added to the mission. And we're a 4-year institution committed to training students in the Bible and a Christian worldview. We have partnered somewhat recently with Lancaster Bible College in Pennsylvania. And so through their larger system, we can offer 26 majors here at Oak Hills.
Oh, wow.
I should also add that Oak Hills continues today as a four-part ministry. Oak Hills Christian College is, of course, the educational arm. We have a church ministries department that specializes in the training of rural church leaders. We have a Center for Indian Ministries that has a national presence with regard to First Nations and Native American leaders. And then we have an on-site, we have a 180-acre campus on two lakes, and so we also have a Christian camp
Oh,
that
wow.
services primarily children and youth. So my role is to give leadership to those four ministries. There's a wonderful staff, of course, that does the heavy lifting for that. But that's Oak Hills, and I'm delighted to be here.
Absolutely, man. What a cool journey. I love just diving into this conversation because it represents not only our academic acumen, but it also represents 40 years of experience as a rural pastor. And so I'm just excited to be talking to you today. But to start our conversation, we're going to kind of start with a statement and then backtrack a little bit. But I really love, as you have shared with me, some of the training that you get to do with rural pastors. Kind of your not even hypothesis, because really you see it happen, but your theory of how the rural mindset and the urban mindset kind of start colliding even in small towns, which I think I was initially taken aback with because I was like, man, small town is small town. There's no, you want to believe that the influence is rather homogenous, that there is just a very clear rural idea and identity. And so before we get to that, though, I would love to break down some of these mindsets as you've defined them. I think I really respect the way that you worded things. And so let's dive into this first. We talk about the rural mindset in literature and in conversation of, there's a certain way of seeing the world. And so what are some of the characteristics that stand out about a rural way of thinking? How would you define that mindset?
Sure. So let me preface the direct answer to that question, Joe, by saying that when I accepted a call to the first church that I served in a rural setting, I went with a rather naive assumption that because I'd grown up in a rural environment, I understood rural. And in fact, I'll say it this way, and I say it with real grace, I had moved 100 miles from home and 50 years back in
Sure.
time. I'd moved from a rather aggressive agribusiness to a subsistence farming area with a lot of poverty. And so that was my awakening to what I didn't know and propelled me to study more carefully exactly what I was. It's a form of culture shock, actually. We expect it when we leave the country to go somewhere else. I didn't expect it internally. And so that was the beginning of a more serious journey in terms of studying the phenomena. For training purposes, let me give you a definition, Joe. Rural is largely defined historically by the agrarian mindset, the mindset that's attached to farming, ranching, those kinds of extractive vocations. And it's a bit wordy definition, but I'll give it to you and your listeners. It's a way of perceiving, thinking, relating, and making decisions that arises from a lifestyle and a livelihood directly dependent on the land and or the extraction of natural God-created resources. So that's a bit wordy, but the essence of it is that rural historically has been highly defined by that dynamic of making a living from the land and by the unpredictable nature, the uncertainties of that experience. Through the generations, probably going back to the biblical times, farmers and their version of ranchers have had to look at the horizon and pray for good weather and hope for rain and not be certain about whether they're going to get an income this year or not. Across Montana and the Western Great Plains, that is still very much a reality. And so uncertainty, it really defines the bedrock of the worldview that agrarian or rural people embrace. Most people go on to say within this context are directly dependent in their livelihood upon resources not originating with people. That's a pretty important distinctive. And many factors influencing the extraction of those resources that are beyond their control, weather, market conditions, societal trends. As an example of that, Joe, when I talk with leaders, societal trends impact their livelihood. Drink milk versus avoid dairy. Depending on which way a region of the country tilts, that affects the income of a farmer. Eat whole grains versus avoid gluten. So even, simple things like that. And political whim, export bans, import-export traffic, and so on. So it's fairly complex underpinnings, but on the surface of it, uncertainty. And then I'll get into some of the distinctives in answer to your question, but let me contrast it, Joe. And I use the term urban, three terms that I use extensively in my work of leadership training: rural, urban, and rurban, Rurban, which is intended to be a collision or an admixture of those two. So I want to say to listeners that have a suburban background that I'm sort of putting all of the urban genres into that term urban. I use it
Sure.
generically. The primary driver these days is suburban, but there's all kinds of subsets, exurban and inner city,
Sure,
and yeah,
sure.
and so it goes. But let me, in contrast, long answer to your short question, in contrast, the urban mindset would be a way of perceiving, thinking, relating, and making decisions dependent on a specialized and interdependent system of commerce that produces and provides goods, services, and information. So it's not about extraction, it's about production and provision. Most urban people make their living by adding a specialized personal skill to this complex living system. So those are, those are some of the characteristics. Now, the contrasts are fairly significant, and that's really what you were asking about as we started this broadcast. Let me just run down a list of those, and then we can linger coming back in whatever points may be of interest.
Absolutely.
So I'm going to give categories bouncing back and forth, Joe, between rural and urban. And these are generalities. Of course, there are exceptions to these rules,
Sure.
but in general, these are helpful contrasts. On the rural side, fewer people versus many people on the urban side. Generally, smaller institutions of all types in a rural setting. You know the name of your banker.
Yep.
In the first town that I served, we had three grocery stores, then two, then one, which closed at 5 p.m. and was not open on the weekends.
Yep.
Large institutions in urban centers. When I did graduate work in Chicago at Moody Bible Institute, the taxi driver in my first trip in pointed to a complex of buildings where 35,000 people punched in to work.
Wow.
I
Jeez.
was arriving there from a town of 900,
Yeah.
and as I mentioned earlier, grew up on a farm. On the rural side, independence is very, very valuable, and it's part of the fabric of life. On the urban side, cooperation is absolutely essential. You can't get anything done at General Motors if you're going to operate alone. You
Right.
just can't. On the rural side, it's a general practitioner environment. We used to use the phrase jack of all trades.
Yeah.
Rural leaders, historically farmers and ranchers and loggers, they're puzzled when they meet specialists because they would say the specialist doesn't know how to do much.
Right.
The farmer, something breaks and he fixes it. If he needs, in the old days, if you needed an overhaul, you just threw up the hood and got the tools and did it in the shade tree. Specialist orientation is important and necessary on the urban side. On the rural side, people often work alone. For instance, as a farm boy, I would spend long, especially in planting and harvest, I might spend 14 or 16 hours in a day operating machine alone, not having interaction with people. And on the urban side, people typically work with others, sometimes in large group settings, sometimes in a smaller office setting. There's lower verbal communication on the rural side, typically. And I should pause to say, Joe, that these things are compounded by other factors. Temperament, of course, enters in,
Yeah.
as does gender. From time to time, I will tease a group of leaders and say, if you want a new definition of silence, invite a dozen rural men into one room and invite them to just share. Okay, fellas, let's just share. Let's have a
Sure.
serendipitous moment, and a hush will follow over the room. Rural men, of which I'm one, we do communicate, but typically in more predictable, safe settings, leaning on a corral fence, looking at the horizon. In my
Yeah.
part of the country, Joe, sitting in a fishing boat facing opposite horizons, and then we can have a more, a deeper conversation. On the urban side, it's a more verbal. You have to learn how to communicate in those large group settings. An important distinctive cooperation in rural settings historically has been for survival. And in most suburban settings, survival is not really an issue. And therefore, there's the freedom to cooperate for achievement. Both groups, both rural and urban cultures, put value on both sides of that equation. Everybody, of course, wants to survive.
Right.
And everybody at some point wants to achieve. But when I give that contrast, rural people, again, historically, have often been in a situation where they had to cooperate so that everybody could survive. One iconic historical example of that would be the barn raising of the early pioneer days. It's now celebrated nostalgically as a great tribute to the close interpersonal relationships and trust of rural places. Actually, at the time, Joe, it was less about close relationship and more about survival.
Sure.
The rules are, if I help you build your barn, you will succeed and survive as a farmer, but you're also obligated to help me build my barn,
Right.
and then we both can operate independently and survive, but without each other, that's not possible.
Yeah.
So I'm not denigrating the kindness of rural people. I'm just saying survival was the issue.
Right.
A cooperation for achievement in rural and urban areas is much more common. Another, I think, important distinctive is on the rural side, cooperation is very egalitarian. It's among equals. Or
Right.
another way to say that would be almost all leaders, men and women in rural settings, would embrace the identity of a CEO. They run their own business, they make
Sure.
their own decisions. And on the suburban side, cooperation is much more multi-level. So I work for somebody, I'm under someone's authority, there are people under my authority, and on down the line. And so we have to cooperate together in some unique sets of relationships to get the job done and to get everybody a paycheck. Management closely related to that. On the rural side is single tier. I used to, as an adolescent guy stepping into farm tasks, at the start of the day, my grandfather, my father, and I, and my brothers would sometimes talk and decide what to do or agree on what to do, although my dad was primarily in charge. So there was a horizontal management tier there, quite unique. That's very rare in suburban or urban settings. Where it's multi-level. Again, I'm exaggerating for emphasis, Joe, but
Sure.
if you're reporting to work at General Motors, you don't go to the front office and lean on the desk and ask the CEO, what should we do today?
Right.
That doesn't happen.
And
So
there's probably
I
six or seven people between you and that CEO that you would have to talk to just to get there. And again, you
exactly.
know, versus, yeah, in a small town, you're talking to the person who owns the hardware store and the person who owns the, you know, the auto parts store and all those things.
Exactly. A couple more, and then this short list is done. Really, really important to ministry leaders on the rural side, group decisions are typically made by informal consensus. Consensus is huge, worth writing down if you're listening,
Yeah.
because rural people will intuitively, by their cultural rules, look for consensus. On the suburban side, the formal process works. So if you're serving a church, Joel, as a pastor, one way to illustrate this contrast would be in a suburban church, a decision made by a formal process and brought to a vote. If you have, oh, I would say 60 to 65% in favor of the initiative, that's an operative majority, and the decision has been made. In many rural churches, if you had a 65 to 35 vote, you've got a split church. You don't have a decision. You have a split church. So I've been asked through the years, so what ratios should we be looking for as a pastor in decision making? And my observation has been that in most rural situations, people are hoping for and looking for about a 90% consensus.
Dang.
They won't necessarily, and that's not a hard and fast rule. Churches can
Sure.
be blended. They won't necessarily always get that. There's usually applause if the decision is unanimous, but they're looking for that, and that's an important, I think, an important truth for rural leadership. And then last on this short list, smaller churches are more the norm in rural settings, and larger churches in suburban settings. There's a curious subset to that, Joe. If a church is blessed by the Lord and there are factors involved that allow it to grow, and this sometimes happens, churches in rural settings grow in some cases dramatically. One of the hidden factors is if the church reaches a certain point, it will outgrow the sociocultural norms in its setting, and it will start to feel unusual or formal, you know. So I can't quantify that specifically, but if most institutions in the community are small, as we've asserted, so maybe I know of a public school, for instance, in northwestern North Dakota, where they still operate as a K-12 with, I think it's probably a couple of hundred students, maybe less, but there's no alternative for those students. They can't be bused to a bigger community. If in that community a church grows to 100 or more, it's starting to outgrow the norm for that community. Now that we don't want to resist God's move, but leaders should be aware of that. In other settings that maybe are more populated, a rural church that goes above the 200 mark would start to feel a little unusual. Now, if you're in that situation as a leader, celebrate God's goodness, thank Him for that. But just be aware, it feels a little unusual. And the result of that, as a sidebar, Joe, is that you're going to start to consider multi-staff. And most rural churches do not have history of multi-staff. They have a pastor. Maybe if they've gotten a bit larger, they have a youth pastor. But if you need to hire a third pastor, your people are going to have a significant adjustment to how you're doing church. That's a sidebar to your main question, but just getting into some granular stuff here. So those are some of the contrasting realities, and the mindsets diverge a bit around those realities, Joe. People relate in different ways.
And I love that list. Very, I can already think as you talk of just situations and moments where these kind of little bits of wisdom, these contrasts really serve as guiding markers for how some of my interactions have happened in a rural church where I go, oh, that's why I ran into that and encountered that, or that's why that turned out the way it did. I can think of a situation where my local church had wanted to open a coffee shop, and we had probably, a higher majority, but certainly not that 80, 90%. And we lost a couple families because there was just frustration with the process, to my shock in some ways, where I was just like,
Sure.
what? How did that happen? Thanks again for tuning in to part one of this awesome conversation with Martin Geese, as he has just started to dive into his own story and the mindsets of rural and urban and how they clash and where they collide. We hope that you've enjoyed the conversation so far, and we encourage you to tune in next week because we're going to continue this conversation about how to manage the underlying tensions that occur in our churches and maybe arm us with the right understanding of what's happening so that we can address situations like this in the future. Again, our goal every week is to equip you, empower you, to help you just feel encouraged to do your job in a small, out-of-the-way place. We want you to know that God values the work that you do there and that we value the work you do there as well. As usual, you can definitely find us at Spotify and Apple Podcast or ruraladvancement.com, and we encourage you to just tell somebody about this podcast who might need to hear this conversation. For this week, I have been your host, Joe Epley. He has been Pastor and President Martin Geese, and we will see you for part two next week.